welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinions, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, Jessica Gross will be on to talk about the very undercovered issue of prenatal depression. Romney picks up a hard-line anti-choice running mate, and Komen gets back into the news because of their attempts to fix their massive PR problem. Elizabeth Banks is now the latest celebrity to make a video supporting Planned Parenthood and making sure women have access to contraception.
Planned Parenthood is something I care very deeply about. Planned Parenthood was my health care provider when I didn't have insurance after graduating from college. Yes, I got birth control, but it was for my massive migraine headaches and my heavy flow. Yeah, I'm on record saying I had a heavy flow. And unfortunately, these are the types of things that I don't want to discuss with employers. I don't want to talk about that with my employer. That's between me and my doctor.
Okay, while heavy flow is funny, I'm really frustrated by the fact that it seems nearly every woman who is willing to speak about birth control excuses it by saying that she used it for some other reason than birth control. Seriously, the fact that you didn't want to raise a kid while you were broke and uninsured is nothing to be ashamed of. You should be proud. Women using contraception are women taking responsibility. We should be patting ourselves on the back for how awesome we are for making sure that we're only having babies when it's right for ourselves and for those babies. Still, she's exactly right that no one should be forced to talk about their intimate matters like this with their boss. After much speculation that invariably looks a little bit foolish in hindsight, Mitt Romney finally announced his running mate on the Republican presidential ticket, Representative Paul Ryan, who is an aficionado of P90X and of complex schemes to bring an end to Medicare as we know it. The vast majority of the attention being paid to Ryan is regarding his extremely dim view of social safety nets and his committed belief towards keeping wealth concentrated in the hands of the 1%. But Ryan's views on reproductive rights are also extremely interesting as well. And in an election where women's issues are so front and center, you can bet a lot of attention is going to be paid to Ryan's views on abortion and contraception. After doing a couple of minutes on how much voters hate the very notion of personhood laws that grant fertilized eggs the status of people who have more claim to a woman's body than she does, and adding that Mitt Romney has been trying hard to run away from his comments claiming to support such laws many months ago, Rachel Maddow said this about Paul Ryan.
And that is one of the reasons why Paul Ryan is such a baffling choice for the Romney ticket. Congressman Paul Ryan, now presumptive vice presidential nominee Paul Ryan, co-sponsored a bill in the House that is a federal version of the Personhood Amendment, the abortion and hormonal birth control ban, the same one that even Mississippi voters rejected last fall. How'd you like it for the whole country? The National Personhood Bill that Paul Ryan co-sponsored declares that, quote, the life of each human being begins with fertilization, cloning, or its functional equivalent, at which time every human being shall have all the legal and constitutional attributes of and privileges of personhood.
More rights, really, because as a legal person, I don't have a right to set up shop in your body and start leaching nutrients against your will, but anti-choicers want to give that right to fertilized eggs. As Rachel said, on the surface, this just seems baffling, because even people who want serious restrictions on abortion often balk at personhood laws, both because they want abortion laws they believe will make an exception for them, and because anti-choicers aren't doing a good job of concealing how much they hope these laws could be used as leverage to restrict access to contraception. Indeed, Ryan has a long history of hostility to greater access to healthcare, especially with regards to reproductive healthcare. Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Interviewed Nicole Safar from Planned Parenthood in Wisconsin about Ryan's record on reproductive healthcare. She specifically talked about Ryan's strong opposition to the contraception mandate.
Right. I mean, it's a really interesting philosophy of government, isn't it? I think that it is so out of touch with what we see on the ground every day, with what women know every day to be the real issue. And it is about getting access to birth control. It really is. Women struggle every day to get access to basic health care like what we provide at Planned Parenthood. And the Affordable Care Act has removed so many barriers for women when it comes to this basic preventative health care, like well women exams and birth control. I think that, you know, Congressman Ryan frames it in this very unique way because he knows that it's so out of touch. He knows that his position is so out of touch from what the women across this country really understand.
Ryan's claim that the opposition to the contraception mandate is about religious freedom is simply implausible. He and Romney have strongly supported cutting off Planned Parenthood's funding for contraception and other non-abortion services. While there's a different excuse for each attack, there's a common thread throughout the policies Ryan supports, from banning abortion to cutting back on various ways to pay for contraception. That thread is reducing women's ability to say when and if they give birth. At a certain point, you have to look at these patterns. The claim from conservatives that it's all a coincidence is straining all disbelief. Michelle Goldberg from the Daily Beast also reported on how Paul Ryan is really far to the right of the country and even to the Republican Party generally on the issue of reproductive rights, which isn't easy to do.
Sponsored a bill that would define life as beginning at the moment of fertilization. It's the exact equivalent of the bill that was too extreme to pass in Mississippi, you know, the Personhood Amendment, that would ban not just abortion, but many forms of birth control. So he's not just kind of a standard issue pro-life Republican. He is one of the most right-wing on issues of abortion that has ever been on a national ticket, comparable to Palin in that regard.
Let me take a couple quick questions.
A lot of commentators are baffled that Romney went with someone who seems so hardline. But I think it fits with what we've seen of the campaign so far. Romney clearly thinks the way to win is to maximize turnout from the conservative base. There's still some suspicion on the right that Romney is more moderate than he seems, so picking someone who is so hostile to expanded healthcare access and reproductive healthcare, especially, is a way to signal that Romney is being serious with his stated opposition to abortion rights, Planned Parenthood, and universal healthcare. I'd like to welcome Jessica Gross to the program. Jessica is a writer and editor who freelances now and used to work as a senior editor for Slate. She recently wrote a two-piece series about prenatal depression and antidepressant drugs, and she's here to talk about it. Welcome to RealityCast, Jess.
Thanks so much for having me, Amanda.
So all this started because of a personal journey. Can you tell me some about your experience with prenatal depression and what you had to do to get yourself fixed up?
Sure. I went off antidepressants when my husband and I started trying to conceive, probably about 2 months before we started trying. And I did it under the care of a psychologist and a psychiatrist, and I thought I had all my bases covered. And I had never heard of prenatal depression. I heard of postpartum depression that seems quite well publicized. And I thought, well, you know, if I need to go back on antidepressants after I have the baby, that should be fine. And I ended up getting really massively depressed during my first trimester. And it was a complete shock to me because I had no idea. You know, I had some sense that it was an emotional time when you were pregnant, but I had no idea that the hormones I was getting and sort of the physical changes I was experiencing could really send me back down a spiral. You know, I had had sort of two bouts of clinical depression in my adult life, and they were both obviously painful but manageable. And this, it was just different because, you know, there's someone else involved. So, you know, I was so lucky to have healthcare and to be under the eye of a psychologist and a medicating psychiatrist who both listened to me. And, you know, we all made the decision together at some point that it was much better for me to go back on antidepressants than to continue to be horribly depressed. And sort of in retrospect, I think had I been seeing an obstetrician or gynecologist consistently through that time, I might have gotten some different advice, or I might have had different feedback. I don't know. It's, you know, my psychologist was not an expert in prenatal depression, so it's not, I'm not to place any sort of blame on her for what happened. But yeah, and so when I went back on antidepressants, really my depression lifted in about a week, which is how I had, you know, responded to antidepressants in the past, which again is very lucky because a lot of people don't respond to antidepressants so quickly or easily. So that was pretty much what happened.
So when I read your article, I was a little surprised because I had never really heard the term prenatal depression, but according to you, it's very common and it affects up to 10% of women. Why do you think there's so little discussion about such a common phenomenon?
I think anything, I think there's a couple things. I think one part of it is that pregnancy culture right now is really messed up, for lack of a more precise term. And there's really a emphasis on relentless positivity and happiness. And so I think any women who are feeling things that aren't necessarily positive or happy feel incredibly guilty that they might, you know, even if it's something that they desperately wanted to be pregnant, not to, you know, and that's like the best case scenario, not to mention that there's lots of women who become pregnant and then they are ambivalent about being pregnant or they don't want to be pregnant. And that's a whole other host of emotions. But, I mean, best case scenario, you're talking about people who want to be pregnant. And I think there's so much cultural pressure to be happy that it's taboo to talk about. I think that's one thing. I think also as we know more and more scientifically about how what's going on in the womb can influence people for life, it gets more and more oppressive what women should and should not do when they're pregnant. There's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of, you know, the research is still in it. There's more knowledge, but the research is still in, for lack of a better word, an embryonic state. So we're sort of in a moment where everything a woman does when she's pregnant is totally scrutinized in this crazy way. So I think women probably feel that treating their depression is just so complicated that maybe they don't even want to acknowledge it because it's such a complex issue and it's such a personal choice. And even doctors and psychologists disagree how to treat each individual woman, that it can just feel so overwhelming, especially when you're in such a difficult state. So I think it's sort of those two things together.
In your article, you looked into the actual risks for the fetus if a woman takes SSRIs. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Sure. I mean, there are risks. It's not any, you take any medication when you're pregnant, there are, you know, it will affect the baby. But the risks, these are really, really heavily studied drugs. And even though the research is not the best quality of research, because you can't do the best quality of research on pregnant women, there is an overwhelming amount of evidence that the risks are really pretty low with these drugs. You know, millions of women have had healthy pregnancies on SSRIs. And even if there are complications after the baby is born, those side effects are often really mild. You know, they disappear within a few days after giving birth. And sometimes with some of the side effects, it's more of a correlation than a causation. They don't know for sure that the mother being on the SSRI caused, you know, a lung problem or a heart problem that the baby had. There, you know, is a very slight increase in some heart problems and lung problems with these drugs. But if you actually look at the numbers, it's such a slight increase overall that if you are really, really suffering, I mean, at least I can only speak for myself. And I have, you know, because I had been on antidepressants in the past and because I had been depressed in the past, I was confident in taking these drugs. I mean, it wasn't the easy decision. It's always hard when you're pregnant, but I knew they would help me and I had done my homework and I felt like the risks were small. But I think, again, it just goes back to this idea that everything has to be natural now and anything you do to affect the baby is evil. And I think that those sort of emotions can cloud the picture a little bit.
Well, and I got the impression from some of the responses that were negative to your article that a lot of people do not think depression is really that big an issue. Can you talk about why depression itself needs to be treated as a risk?
Oh, sure. The risks of untreated prenatal depression can be even worse for a developing fetus than the smaller risks of antidepressants. I mean, women take much worse care of themselves. They can't and don't eat or sleep right when they are feeling depressed. There's a much higher risk for drug and alcohol abuse when you are depressed. This is especially a huge problem among low-income women who have a vastly higher rate of prenatal depression. And just stress alone, sort of anxiety and stress the mother is feeling, there's some evidence that that is damaging to a child. And you have no idea what is the stress threshold for each mother is probably different. You know, the amount of stress that reaches some tipping point where it is damaging to the baby. But do you really want a woman to have to suffer through the point where she's finding that out? And there's also a risk of preterm labor. That's a big one with women who are anxious and depressed. So, I don't know what to say to people who just don't believe in depression. I sort of feel sorry for them because God forbid someone in their life has to go through it, or they themselves. I mean, anyone can be depressed, not just pregnant women, not just women, men. You know, someday if they get really depressed, are they just going to hate themselves? I mean, it's just so preposterous at this point to me that I sort of feel sorry for them and the people that surround them. And sort of the final risk for women who have untreated depression is the risk to their family members. I mean, women who have committed partners, the marital quality just declines so completely when you have a depressed spouse. It's horrible for the men who have to see women they love go through this. And if women have other children, they can't take adequate care of other children when they're massively depressed. I mean, the sort of repercussions outside just the mother and the baby can be really huge. My husband read some of the comments. I don't read comments on my personal essay because at this point in my writing career, I just know better. It's just going to make me upset and angry in a way that's not productive. But my husband read some of them and he was really upset. You know, it was such a hard period for both of us that for people to be dismissive is just cool. So, I mean, I don't know what to do to these people. They're the list. I think that the risk, it's impossible to say with each woman whether it's worse to have it be untreated or to give them medicine. I mean, I think for a lot of women, the balance shows that it's much worse for them to be untreated. And there just should be so much more support for pregnant women in so many ways, but this is one very, very important one.
My guest today has been Jessica Gross. You can find the articles titled Not Just the Pregnancy Blues at Slate.com. You're also doing a survey, correct?
Yes.
So if you've had...
please take the survey.
If you've... you haven't completed it yet, though, right?
No. It's ongoing.
Okay, awesome. So if you have had issues of pregnancy and depression, you can go fill out the survey and help them out. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Jess.
Thanks again for having me. I got love for you if you were born in the
80s. Remember months ago when Susan G. Komen, Race for the Cure, injected themselves foolishly into the debate over Planned Parenthood and subsidized contraception access generally by cutting off grants that Planned Parenthood was using for breast exams, and then, under an absolute ton of controversy, quickly reinstating them and pushing out the anti-choice extremist Karen Handel, who was blamed for the decision? Reinstating the grants and getting rid of the problem person was a desperate move, and it was largely, as Brian Williams explains, unable to do much for the reputation of the organization.
The controversy involving the Susan G. Komen Foundation has soiled one of the great names and best-known brand names in all of charity. The instantly recognizable and zealously guarded trademark pink ribbon always stood for one thing. It was the symbol of the fight against breast cancer until controversy came along. And Komen cut funds for Planned Parenthood, a decision it later reversed.
How badly the brand was damaged wasn't immediately easy to measure, but it was understood that by midsummer everyone would know. That's because the early summer is when Komen had their annual races in a whole messload of cities, races that raise millions upon millions of dollars for their organizations. If there wasn't a substantial drop in fundraising, then it could be assumed Komen weathered the storm. But if there was one, then it would be difficult to conclude that these dust-ups hadn't created lasting PR problems for the nonprofit. Unfortunately for them, the latter is what happened.
Like the one in Seattle, where the annual race for the cure raised $500,000 less this year, with participation down 30%. Donations also are down sharply in many other parts of the country.
After numbers like that, it seems the leadership of Komen is realizing that their efforts to recover from this PR disaster were insufficient. CEO Nancy Brinker announced that she'll be stepping down to take a smaller role. The foundation denies that this was a direct response to the controversy, but that's a line exactly no one, including those involved with the affiliates, appears ready to buy. Indeed, NBC interviewed a couple of women who still work with Komen but were disappointed by all this and hope that this is the move that's finally going to get the ship right again. But there's reason to be skeptical.
But on the web, some skepticism. Too little, too late. I will never, ever trust Komen again. This longtime donor says she's still not giving any more money.
I see this as window dressing and as PR. I mean, the bottom line is Nancy Brinker will still be running the organization.
The biggest loser in all this, low-income women. Komen's troubles mean less money to help women who can't afford mammograms or cancer treatment.
Komen does genuinely do a lot of good for low-income women. But of course, that's the problem at the center of all this. By pulling that grant in the first place, they sent the signal that they would sacrifice the healthcare needs of low-income women to pander to the misogynist forces, who really are the last people you should ever listen to when it comes to women and healthcare. You can take it back, but the fact that you ever gave credit to the opinion of misogynists in the first place is something that's hard to forget. It's hard to blame people for being wary, especially since there are a lot of demands on charitable giving. Most people care about a variety of issues, and it's very easy for them to just switch causes in light of something like this. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. Having a discussion that involves no relationship to Reality Edition. This is a clip of Representative Todd Akin being asked about the so-called morning after pill, which is a pill that prevents pregnancy after sex but before the sperm has a chance to get near the egg.
Listen, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to get to the actual morning after pill, though. So are you saying that you would like that to be banned for everyone, or do you have exceptions for rape and incest, or what is your position?
As far as I'm concerned, the morning after pill is a form of abortion, and I think we just shouldn't have abortion in this country.
No exceptions for rape, incest, life of the mother, no exceptions at all?
Well, the life of the mother, the situation there is one where I think what you want to do is optimize life. You try to save the mother's life, you try to save the child. There are certain things like, you get a tubal pregnancy, where the child has absolutely no chance of surviving, and then you do the best you can to save the mother's life. So I think you optimize life is the way I would probably describe it. So
just to be clear, though, you would like to ban the morning after pill totally for everyone?
Yeah, I think that's a form of abortion, and I don't support it.
Emergency contraception works by preventing ovulation before sperm can make the multi-day journey to the fallopian tubes. Any opposition to it, therefore, is rooted in the assumption that once a man ejaculates in a woman, the sperm actually have more rights than she does to determine what happens to her body. Throw in the no exceptions for rape thing, and you're basically arguing that men have a right to force random women to get pregnant against their will. I'm not accepting the plea of biological ignorance anymore. They've been told that emergency contraception works by preventing ovulation. At this point, it's basically an expression of the belief that a woman's basic rights disappear the second sperm touches her body.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.